6 years ago, the Blackwood family sat down to dinner. Only three survived. Now, 18-year-old Mary Catherine lives with her sister Constance in their ancestral home, venturing into the hostile village twice weekly for supplies while enduring whispered accusations and children's cruel rhymes about poison tea. What unfolds is not a simple tale of family tragedy, but a masterwork of psychological horror that asks unsettling questions. What happens when the world decides you're guilty? When isolation becomes not punishment, but sanctuary? When the price of protection is silence about unspeakable truth? Shirley Jackson's final novel operates like a music box wound too tight, beautiful, intricate, and dangerous. Through Maricat's distinctive voice, we enter a world where deadly nightshade grows in the garden, where buried treasures form magical protection, and where the greatest threat isn't the past, but the possibility of change. The Blackwood house stands frozen in time. Constance never leaves. Uncle Julian, paralyzed from the poisoning that killed their family, obsessively documents that fatal night. Only Maricat ventures into the hostile village, enduring stares and taunts with rigid determination. Their existence runs on clockwork precision. Tuesdays and Fridays for village trips, Thursdays for wearing dead relatives' clothing, Mondays for cleaning while preserving everything exactly as it was. The cellar holds generations of preserved food, jam from great-grandmothers, pickles from great-aunts, vegetables from grandmother. Constance's rose shine brightest among them all. But Maricat's protection extends beyond routine into magical thinking. She buries treasured objects around the property, a doll beneath a rock, silver dollars by the creek, her father's watch near the creek. She nails his book to a tree as a talisman. She chooses three magic words, Melody, Gloucester, and Pegasus, keeping them secret and powerful. These rituals form a coherent system for controlling chaos, a magical boundary between sanctuary and threat. This fortress has protected them for 6 years, until it doesn't. Charles Blackwood arrives wearing a smile and carrying ambition. He's their cousin, but more significantly, he looks like their father, a resemblance Constance finds comforting and Maricat finds threatening. Within days, he's sleeping in their father's room, sitting in their father's chair, wearing their father's clothes. His big white face watching everyone eat, Maricat observes with visceral disgust. Charles's true interest quickly surfaces, money. He questions whether the crazy kid hasn't buried thousands of dollars all over, takes Maricat's silver dollars to their father's safe, and suggests selling family heirlooms. More dangerously, he begins changing Constance, who starts criticizing herself for hiding and letting Maricat run wild, suggesting Uncle Julian belongs in a hospital. The power struggle escalates. Maricat retaliates through domestic terrorism, stopping his watch, transforming his room with sticks and broken glass, tearing down curtains, pouring water on his bed. Later, she knocks his burning pipe into a wastebasket full of newspapers. The resulting fire breaches everything they've protected. As flames consume the upper floors and firemen trample through their sanctuary, Charles's voice cuts through the chaos. Get the safe in the study. His priorities, laid bare in crisis, reveal everything. But the fire is only the beginning of the night's horrors. What begins as rescue becomes ritual destruction. When Fire Chief Jim Donnell smashes their mother's drawing room window, the crowd surges forward, not to help, but to destroy. They break possessions, chant their cruel rhyme, and form a circle blocking every escape. The mob's violence reveals 6 years of accumulated hatred. The kitchen table is overturned, chairs smashed, the floor covered with broken dishes. Jars shatter against walls, silverware bent and scattered, family tablecloths ripped and soiled. The sink is methodically filled with broken glass, evidence of calculated malice, not chaos. Only Uncle Julian's death temporarily breaks the bloodlust, allowing escape. When they return at dawn, their home is a nightmare of black and twisted wood above, but the cellar door remains closed. All of Constance's preserves survive intact, symbolic of their own resilience. In the damaged kitchen, over canned food, the novel's central mystery unravels. Constance apologizes for mentioning why they all died, and Merrickett's response is devastatingly simple. "I put it in the sugar." "I know," Constance replies. "I knew then." This exchange illuminates everything. Merrickett, at 12, poisoned their family with arsenic. Constance, knowing the truth, chose protection over justice. The sugar bowl Constance washed before police arrived, that curious act that damned her, was protection, not guilt. Merrickett's survival that night, she was confined to her room without dinner as punishment, transformed punishment into salvation. Rather than flee or rebuild, the sisters embrace their damaged home's new form. Their house is now turreted and open to the sky, with destroyed rooms closed off and windows covered with cardboard. Though the kitchen was now dark, it was safe, Merrickett observes. The broken stairway and boarded windows become beloved landmarks rather than damaged to repair. This physical transformation mirrors their psychological evolution. They've incorporated hatred and violence into their identity, transforming outcast status into power. Their ruined house becomes a visible symbol of difference, a badge of honor rather than shame. Most remarkably, the villagers' perception shifts from hatred to fearful respect. Children warn each other, "If you go on those steps, the ladies will get you." When a boy taunts them, his parents leave eggs on the doorstep with a note reading, "He didn't mean it, please." The sisters has become legendary witches requiring appeasement. The villagers begin leaving daily offerings of food and gifts, completing the sisters' transformation from victims to figures of power. "Poor strangers," Merrickett observes, "they have so much to be afraid of." When Charles returns seeking their buried money, his dramatic plea, "If you let me go this time, you'll never see me again," is met with laughter. They have transcended his power to hurt them. The novel closes with the sisters fully inhabiting their new reality. When Constance admits, "Well, I am afraid of spiders," Merrickett promises protection. "Jonas and I will see to it that no spider ever comes near you." Then comes the final declaration. "Oh, Constance, we are so happy." This happiness, emerging from murder and destruction, reveals something profound about sanctuary and belonging. The sisters have found their true place, not in society, but in opposition to it, transforming persecution into power and isolation into strength. Jackson's masterpiece asks uncomfortable questions about protection and love. Constance's choice required accepting society's condemnation and living with someone capable of murder. Merrickett's love coexists with the violence that freed them from patriarchal control. Their bond transcends conventional morality, placing family protection above all other ethics. In a world demanding conformity, the Blackwood sisters have created something rare, a space entirely their own, impervious to outside judgment. Their ruined castle stands as testament to choosing your own exile, transforming rejection into personal mythology. They have always lived in the castle. Now the castle lives in the village's imagination too, a reminder that sometimes the greatest power lies not in belonging, but in the courage to remain beautifully, dangerously apart.